You're listening to Spilling Ink.
Wandering free, wish I could be part of your world.
All right, everybody, welcome to another episode of Spilling Ink, the talk show that takes you behind the authors in the indie publishing world. I am the great and powerful Jason. With me today is my co-host, the remarkable and indomitable Katie Salaitis.
Hello!
Katie's still working on waking up. She hasn't had coffee yet this morning. So. Okay, we're getting through that. Don't mind that grinding sound. That's one of our guests today. Today with us, we have the Emperor herself, PK Tyler.
Hello!
And her Sith Lord apprentice, Jessica West.
Hi.
I don't think I'd call her my apprentice.
No.
She's far too advanced for that.
So how are you guys doing today?
I'm good, other than my poor computer ruining your entire show. But, you know.
It won't be ruined. It'll be something to talk about.
Everyone can now witness the conditions under which I have to work.
I was going to say, we need to get you a grant or something for some new computer equipment.
I know, right? My husband works in IT. You'd think he'd be able to steal me something at least.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, you got to take advantage of that.
So, Pav, what do you do? Tell us a little bit about you.
I do a little bit of everything. I'm a little bit schizophrenic when it comes to the writing world. I make sure that my uncommon anthologies are running and marketed and going with the best possible authors we can find. That series focuses on magical realism, which is an absolute love of mine, but doesn't always have a market, especially in the indie world. So I really enjoy getting the chance to bring new authors some exposure. And I write my own novels. And I market. I work for Novel Publicity and Lit Ring as a marketer. And participate in just about every crazy scheme that I can think up or that someone comes up with that sounds exciting because, you know, shiny.
How does somebody get into one of your anthologies, PK?
The Uncommon Anthologies are open call. Fighting Monkey Press. That's the website or that's the name of our page on Facebook. We have regular open calls, usually twice a year, and there's a theme for every story. We've done Uncommon Bodies, Uncommon Minds, Uncommon Origins, and right now we're working on Uncommon Lands up next, but I'm sure it will be something exciting that will hopefully inspire people. And we take unsolicited submissions. You don't need to contact us first. You don't need to know us first. We want to hear from as wide a group of authors as possible, published, unpublished, all diversity is available, and just pick the best stories possible to make sure that we have some really exciting stuff for readers.
Now, when you do your anthologies, are they exclusive stories? Are they limited term exclusivity, or can they be republished from stuff that's already available?
Well, traditionally, they have been just exclusive for a couple of months for KDP purposes. But now that KDP has been cracking down, what qualifies as exclusive? Exclusive has to be now with the same publisher. We're having difficulty pulling in reprints. I'm fine with publishing reprints. I think that if a story is fabulous, a story is fabulous, and that's, as far as I'm concerned, I'm happy to bring it a wider readership. But we're still kind of negotiating exactly what our terms need to be as we're dealing with the change in KDP and how they really cracked down on people. And I understand why they do it. They don't want people double dipping on the same story. But at the same time, it limits a model of what an anthology or a magazine of a specific genre is able to do. So has something that's been previously published, they should shoot us an email and we can talk it out and figure out how to make it work, because we're more interested in getting the best stories possible than we necessarily are in EP's rules. But we're We don't have to do the same thing with every book.
And the reason I ask this is because it really draws on that topic that you touched on with KDP and the issues that they're having. So I want to go back to it, but we've got to talk to our other guest as well and give her a little screen time. But let's put a pin on that and come right back to it.
She can talk about it too. She's right in the middle of the Uncommon Anthologies right with me.
A lot of us are dealing with that right now, so it's kind of a hot topic in the anthology world. But yeah, let's talk to our other guest here. Jessica, do you want to tell us about your stuff?
All we could hear was...
He froze. I didn't hear anything at all, including the fan. The monster fan was just silent. I didn't hear anything. I was just talking.
we'll give you a restart, Jessica, so you can tell us a little bit about what you write.
Take two.
Okay. Well, what I write? I write fantasy, speculative fiction. I write anything that falls under that umbrella. Horror, fantasy, some sci-fi, but not much of that. I'm kind of like Pav. I'm into everything. I like to do a variety of things. I don't like to do one thing and just stick with that one thing. Except I'm an instigator, where she's the leader. She's the one that does most of the work and gets things going and gets things moving. I'm just the instigator. I like to give people ideas and push for that.
Okay. Awesome. Awesome.
Running.
In other words, Jess is the troublemaker. Jess is the one responsible for all the trouble, and I make everything awesome. That's how it works.
I have a good friend like that. He comes up with great ideas, but he's just the idea guy. He doesn't want to actually do it. He wants somebody else to do his evil plans.
I think we all know somebody a little bit like that.
Oh, yeah.
So all three of us – well, sadly, not you, Katie, but Pav, Jessica, and I are all in this month's Tales of the Canyons of the Damned. I believe it is issue 15. Is that right? Do you guys know?
I think so. Was there another one after the Valentines?
Yeah, there was. There was, I think.
Yeah.
That's right.
This is.
Oh. Well, he sent me a
cover. I'm not 100% sure.
Where's Daniel?
He sent me a cover, and I thought it said 15 on it, but. No. So anyhow.
I'm still editing mine, so.
What? It comes out in 2 days.
When you're like, where?
That's what Jess and I did all morning.
So I know we've talked about Tales from the Canyons of the Damned on the show a couple times because we've had Daniel on and a few other people. And basically it's sci-fi and horror slipstream. Could you guys tell us a little bit about what your stories are going to be like in this issue without spoiling them for us?
Pav, I'm going to let you go first because I don't remember mine. I'm going to have to look and see which one he's publishing. I don't remember.
That's what happens when you have a shitload of stories out.
I wrote a while back, so I've been done for a while now. It's just been chilling out. And I don't, but I have no idea.
My story is called Devour, and it's actually part of the first novel I ever tried to write, which when I tried to turn it into a full novel was an utter disaster because I had no idea what I was doing. But there were some really lovely parts of it. So I and made it into a cohesive story and was able to put it together into something that I think is really exciting. It's definitely horror. It's my take on zombies. It's different from a lot of my other stuff that I've written. Yeah, I'd say it's different. Let me massage it even further. What, dear?
It's a zombie story, and it's awesome. When I got it, I was so excited because I was like, Pav wrote this? No way. It's amazing. It's awesome.
Sweet. I can't wait. I haven't been given any kind of story files, and I really wanted to read them before today, but Daniel's holding out on me, so.
Well, you can't have mine because it's not done. It's supposed to publish in 2 days, and it's not done.
I can send you mine, but it's too late now.
That's cool. Well, the one I've got in Canyons this month is longer. It's, you know, it's lot 187, and I think it's 10 or 11,000, and Daniel took some convincing, but I think he really liked the story, and it's about a tattoo artist who gets this crazy batch of ink that kind of comes to life and causes all sorts of mayhem. So definitely horror and way out there, kind of paranormal horror type of thing. You have read that story.
I loved that one. Yeah, that was freaky.
Well, you were thinking the first one that read that before I sent it to Daniel. So, yeah. So, Jess, did you figure out what you have in this issue?
Yes, it's a ghost story. No one will believe.
All right. Now, we've been throwing around some fancy words this morning, like magical realism and speculative fiction. So, for all of us out there that might not be as smart and fancy as you two, could you explain to us a little bit about what that means? What is magical realism to you guys?
Pav, do you want to take it?
Sure. Magical realism is a genre that is based in the world around us, just common everyday life, but where actions which occur take on deeper meaning. It can take on a deeper meaning in the sense of being literary deeper meaning, or there can actually be events that aren't possible to happen in the world around us. Some people confuse it with urban fantasy. They really like witches and vampires in urban settings, where magical realism is world as it is, and then introduce one magical element. So Haruki Murakami is a perfect example of magical realism, where one minute he's kind of a gumshoe detective, the main character, and the next minute he is in the subways and there are these black slithering shadow monsters. It's the real world. Everything else is based in physics and the real laws of existence, but there are certain things that come in representatively in a magical way. A great collection of them, and I can't remember the author's name, I feel horrible, she's an uncommon author, you might know Jess, who wrote Reptilian Handbags and Other Stories, which is one of my favorite magical realism collections in the indie world.
I don't remember that one, but you know what, Jason, your story is a really good example of magical realism also, because you have this guy, he's a tattoo artist, and everything is, it's just going smoothly, exactly how you expect it to. And then all of a sudden there's this element introduced that's like, wait a minute, what's happening here? And as it unfolds, you understand and you know what's happening, you learn what's happening, but it's not of this world. It's just realistic enough for you to think, wow, what if that really happened one day, you know? But it's your logical mind is there to tell you, no, that wouldn't really happen. That, you know, it's there to assure you. But that's a great example of magical realism, because you have that one element that's just a little bit off and it throws the main character a hell of a curveball. So that's magical realism to me, is that it's just everything is exactly what you expect it to be, except you have one element that just changes everything.
I found it.
Oh, you found it. Good.
The Evolution of Reptilian Handbags and Other Stories.
Good.
And it's by Melanie Lamaga, and she's one of our uncommon authors. That's her own book. I try to read as much as I can out of between Insta Freebie and NetGalley and everything else that's out there. I'm always trying to find new authors so I can invite them to maybe submit to us, but we also take open submissions, obviously. And it's a really neat way to find books that aren't being talked about all over the place, that aren't the next biggest, coolest vampire shifter romance baby book, but that really you want to read, you want to support, you want this literature to get in front of people, and that's really exciting work to do.
Now, when it comes to anthologies,
I don't need shifter baby books because I do.
Now, when it comes to anthologies, how do you go about putting them together?
Instinctually.
Yes. Yes, just instinctively we manage.
Do you start off with a theme and then kind of go from there, or you know, how does the idea for your next anthology come out?
Invariably I come up with some wacky idea that doesn't make sense to anyone but me. And then I suggest it now to the Uncommon Authors private group where we can get together and talk. And that includes everybody who's ever been in an Uncommon anthology. And I go, what if we did Uncommon Lands? And then they all go, that's horrible. I don't want to do that. And I go, well, we're going to do Uncommon Lands. Go write stories. And they do. And that's...
Well, sometimes we vote. Uncommon Lands, though, I think we both just, you and I both had, it was a bone we had in our teeth. We both wanted to do that one so bad. So it was like, okay, this is what we're doing next. And it's working out, you know, people are submitting stories and I think it's going to be another great collection. So, yeah.
But that's Uncommon Origins and Uncommon Minds was done by the collective. We voted on it. But Jess and I usually come up with a couple of harebrained ideas and then present them. Uncommon Bodies, which was our first one, was honestly something I'd always wanted to do. I'd recently read a collection of short stories called Bearded Women, which, you know, if you want me to run off, I can probably find that one too. And it's just a little tiny collection all by the same author, tropes from kind of 1930s, 1940s freak shows, and then gives them all stories in the modern world. And it's somewhere between magical realism and literary fiction and just bizarro fiction. But all the stories were so cool. And the idea of writing about an abnormal body, but in a normal setting and not abnormal way, in a way that's not shaming, in a way that's not making fun of, but in a way that really takes what we consider to be uncommon to an extreme. And I was only going to do one. Bodies, I had a story I wanted to write. I knew a couple other authors who were interested. I opened it up and like the submissions just poured in. Uncommon Origins, I think we had over 150 submissions for this little tiny, you know, we don't really make any money. We don't really rank. We just love doing it. Jess and I make no money. It goes back to Jess and I. We pour right back into the marketing for it so that our authors get as much exposure and the anthology can do as much to support our community as possible.
Right.
And that ties right into the next question I was going to ask. How do you handle your submissions? Is it a paid for submission? Is it a buying into the anthology? There's a lot of different ways that anthologies handle this.
No one pays us a cent ever. I don't believe in that personally. I know box sets do it and all that money goes into marketing, or at least ever been involved in, all the money's gone into marketing. But as a company, our philosophy is to try to be as ethical as possible. And so authors submit, royalties are split 50-50. 50% goes back to the authors. That 50% of what we make split by 20 authors is not a lot of money. So although we may have a decent income and get decent ranking and I run sales and I'm marking it constantly throughout the year, all four books now, it's still split 20 ways. So this isn't a money-making scheme. You're not going to get a $4,000 check from me. But it's nice to make a little something on your art. And I do believe that artists should be paid for art. So keeping that as a part of the contract is really important to me, even if it's a small amount, to make sure that artists are being compensated for their work. The other 50% comes back to Jess and I. You know, technically, I could take half of that and pay myself for being the publisher, producer, marketer, formatter, and all that stuff. And 50% goes to Jess, and technically, she could take it for being co-curator and editor and cat wrangler with all the authors and making sure that everything is running smoothly. But we both decided that we're not as interested in making the money as we are in making sure that the books get out. So we churn all of what we make right back into marketing both previous and into marketing the next coming anthology to make sure that each book has a decent amount of money preloaded so that it can launch well.
We're talking about how do you market these anthologies? What goes into the marketing?
Oh, okay. Well, I don't know. Pav does all the marketing. I'm the one who does the behind the scenes stuff for the editing and everything. I don't know, Pav. I don't have that part of your brain.
You should. Why did we do the transfer? What was the point of the whole transfer?
I know, man. I don't know. brain,
we market as aggressively as we can. I market on Amazon. I'm getting involved in Amazon ads. I know I'm a little bit late to the game, but I didn't want to do it until I had the money that I could front to do it well. And now that we've kind of built up some money between Jess and my royalty cut, I'm starting to work on Amazon ads. I do aggressive Facebook ads. I don't do a lot of blog tours, but I try to do blog spotlights to get as many people talking about and sharing about each release as possible. But we also do sales, we do giveaways, we do... Sometimes the authors want to put them together, and they're oodles of fun. I find that usually everybody who comes is either one of the authors or somebody who's already bought one of our group's projects. So for uncommon anthologies, they just don't have the return on investment. Some other books have a great return on investment in them, and maybe it's just because I'm doing them wrong. But we have a lot of fun. I don't know. I do everything. I do everything I can think of. I've done spree casts. I've done head talkers. I've done... I mean, really, if somebody is like, if you painted the cover of the book on a plastic bag and flew it over in Newark, New Jersey, that would sell books. I'll do it.
That's kind of the trend, though, with marketing. It's a lot of throwing shit at the wall and seeing what sticks, because there is no one size fits all when it comes to it. And that's one of the reasons I asked, because we're talking to different authors each week, and everybody has had a different approach. Everybody has had a different tactic that's worked for them. So we're kind of letting our audience see, you know, what the availability is for different tactics and what they can try.
The Uncommon Anthologies, and also Jess and I co-wrote a novel. It's a series. We haven't written the second one yet. We co-wrote a novel called Sin Eater, and we have the same issue with that book as we have with the Uncommon Anthologies, which is it's not a mainstream commercial product. Uncommon Anthologies is never going to be in your local Target. It's just not going to happen. And that's okay. Like, we didn't write it for that. Sin Eater is never going to be featured on USA, Good Morning America or whatever it is. Like, they don't want us there.
Fine.
That's not why we wrote it.
It's not going to be one of Oprah's favorite reads.
Doubt it.
Oprah really wants
no,
to
mama.
See what'd you say, honey?
I'm reading it. I was on the phone with my mom the other day, and she says, I'm reading this book, and I'm trying to pretend that Pavarotti wrote all of it. It's like, okay, yeah, do that.
Because they know you?
Yeah.
Sin Eater is kind of like if you took the Winchester brothers and had them team up with Constantine and made them all gay, and then threw in a Romani who was way smarter than any of them, and then they just kind of kick ass.
Yeah.
So it was a hugely fun book to write. But what is our audience? Like, how do you target that? I like booking an ad on Kindle Nation Daily is not going to sell this book. So I do a lot of Facebook ads and BookBub ads and Amazon ads to try to target people who are already interested in the things that kind of will appeal to the same reader. And the same thing with Uncommon Anthologies. These aren't books that people are going to pick up in hot new releases. Sometimes we get on hot new releases and we're all very proud. And then it just goes, whoop, and that's okay too. We just have to find people who already want to read about magical realism. We're already excited. We have huge cross promotions with Canyons. A lot of the same readers there.
Being an anthology, you can bank on the appeal of each author within that anthology. They can reach out to their fan base. They can throw their own parties, I'm assuming, or do their own blog spots, things like that.
Right.
Some other collections, we don't choose people based on their audience. We've had authors who don't know how to use Facebook, have no mailing list. And we've had authors who come in like gangbusters and can just market the hell out of it without us even asking. But that goes along with the philosophy of why we do this. It's both to support the people who we enjoy working with and to help encourage careers, but also to bring in people who don't have the knowledge of how to sell an indie book. And kind of guide them through the process through doing this.
It's a good educational experience for them, I'm assuming, too.
I think so. I hope so. Jess does amazing. She, like, mentors each author individually. And that's 20 authors per collection. And she works with each one individually, intensively, through multiple rounds of edits. It's amazing what she does.
Why am I so great and everyone else is not so great?
Yes, yes. Let's go back to your editing for a minute. So you edit not only the Uncommon anthologies, you also just got hired by Evolve Publishing to be an editor, is that correct?
Right.
And then you also edit for private authors by commission, right?
Right, freelance. I do a lot of freelance work. Mostly that's where most of my clients come in, is the freelance work. And as far as I can tell, you know, the Evolve Publishing is going to work about the same. I can't really get into details about that because that's, you know, that's giving away somebody else's secrets. And we don't want to do that. But okay. For Evolve Publishing, yeah, I just got hired on, so I'm new. I'm the newbie, and, you know, I'm going to have to get used to their process and learn how things are going. But just based on what I've seen so far, they hold everybody to a higher standard of expectations. And they have a very, what do you call that, strenuous process for when they're selecting which works they'll publish, which ones they'll accept in the first place. And what I was talking about earlier was I don't really do that. When I get an author send me their work, I give them a quote and I tell them about how long it's going to take me and what I think I will need to work on. And I give them my absolute worst. And by worst, I mean my best. I give it to them brutally as I possibly can so that they are fully prepared. Because that first pass you get back from me, a lot of authors are like, okay, yeah, this isn't too bad. I can handle this. And then they take a few days and they come back and they're like, okay, I need a little bit of help. I can handle this, but I need a little bit of help. You know, it's just, it's very, very involved, especially that first process. But I don't turn anyone away. If the story needs developmental help or structural help, I'll work you through that. And we'll do whatever we need to do. We'll go as deep as we need to go. And you know, the time frame and whatnot, the turnaround, it reflects all the work that we're doing. So, you know, it can be a bit overwhelming. But I think my process, for the most part, is very straightforward and easy. That first pass is always the hardest. But once you get beyond that, the rest of it's very easy. It's smooth sailing. It's just the potential is there. The framework is there. I just want to make sure everything else is in place as well before we move on to all the grammar and everything else. So that's basically my process. I just throw a lot of shit at you for the first round. And then after that, we just, you know, we do the other stuff, the grammar stuff.
So you do the full on developmental editing pass followed by the line by line edits, the copy edits.
Yes, I do both. We start with developmental edits, and a lot of stories won't need it. You know, especially the short stories that come in, you know, could be fixing a line or two here or there, giving a little bit more background or taking out some background, things like that, working to make sure that the character has an emotional arc, you know, or a physical change or some kind of change from beginning to end. You know, just making sure all of the elements are in place so that the story accomplishes whatever the author intended it to. And a lot of stories, they won't even need that. Like I said, especially the short stories, because most authors, especially ones who've been doing this for a while and they write novels and things like that, they've got the structure and the development parts down. They just need somebody to come in and polish it off. So, you know, sometimes that's all I do. I go in and basically I'm doing proofreading for some stories. And a lot of times authors will send their short stories to another editor before they send it to me, you know, so that helps too. And that reduces some of the work that we have to do between the two of us. But, you know, there's a broad spectrum, especially for anthologies like the Uncommon anthologies. I was juggling two anthologies. So I had 50 authors and 50 stories, but there's such a broad spectrum of what type of editing each story needs.
Wow. Now, what is your background? How did you get into editing?
In 2013, after I had my third daughter, my husband and I, we decided I would stay home with her instead of working like I did with the oldest two. And just on a whim, you know, I had more time on my hands. So on a whim, I took a writing course online and it just really just snowballed from there. I was writing and could not stop. Even when it's hard, you know, and I can't force myself to write, I'm writing something else. And the editing, I got started with that it started with critique groups, and it just snowballed from there. My skills as an editor evolved a lot more quickly than my skills as a writer did. There's always things, new things to learn. And of course, you know, I have to update my style guides and whatnot to reflect the current conventions. But editing, for the most part, once you get your feet underneath you and you have a process, you establish a workflow, and you learn what you're capable of and what you can do, what you can accomplish, and you're set. So that's why I enjoy editing, is that as long as I stay on top of the current conventions and what needs to be done, then I'm set. I'm good. But the writing and the publishing, that part is it's always changing. It's like walking across quicksand. So editing has been throughout this process since 2013. It's always been that thing that I've held on to that kept me above the quicksand.
How did you end up working with Pav? What got you two together?
An online workshop. We had a mutual friend that we met via Twitter. I think I met him on Twitter first and then Facebook and whatnot. You know how those things go. And we took this online. What?
I said Tinder.
Is there a Tinder for authors? That'd be awesome.
No, not quite there. We don't go that far. I don't have a Tinder profile. I'm just about everywhere else, though. Yeah, so we met Grindr via mutual friends, and it went from there. It was like magic. We just clicked.
Yeah, and you guys do have some a strange relationship with some unusual pet names for each other. I've learned that much as well.
Well, Jess and I, one of the things that first drew us to each other, I think, was that neither of us were writing inside any kind of box or hexagon or really shape of any sort. And yet there was so much meat in the work, even if it wasn't polished. Like editing Jess's work is fabulous. It's so much fun because there are so many layers to what she's trying to say. And as an author, getting a critique from someone who wasn't afraid to tell me, you know, this really sucks. Stop, delete all this, and start over, because this is horrible and I know you can do better. And I want that. As, you know, a couple, are we a couple as a partnership, maybe? I don't know. We're brutally honest, which has its ups and its downs, because there have been times one of us had to call the other at like 10 o'clock at night, like, are you mad at me? Why would you do that? Side is that we really are able to accomplish something when we work together that I think is rare, which is focusing on the work, not focusing on our own egos, not focusing just on what we want something to be, but really getting down to how good can we get this work. And I find that incredibly refreshing. It's one of the reasons why I always recommend Jess as an editor and why I've used her as an editor myself. I published with Evolved, and I was so thrilled when she came through. I had no doubt that she would pass the very stringent editing requirements that they have there, because I've worked with her. And it's just so refreshing to be able to have someone that you can completely trust with your work and know that they're not going to worry about pussyfooting around telling you when something sucks. Because we need to hear that. Even the most accomplished authors need to hear, you know, this one's a no.
Yeah, and that's part of being an author, is being able to take that criticism and not just curl up into a little ball and cry like I did when I got rejection letter from an editor a couple weeks ago. And I was like, oh my God, I'm just going to go away and die and not speak to anyone for a week. But you have to come back from that shit, because if you don't, you're never really going to be an author. You're never really going to learn. You're never going to improve your work and your craft. And you're never going to be able to deal with all the trolls out there that, you know, even if your work is fabulous, there's still going to be people that are going to pick your ass apart. And you've got to be able to take it. You've got to be able to take
it.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. I've been working in professional arts for over 20 years. I started in theater. I worked off Broadway, and then I was able to work on Broadway for a while. And then moved to DC and was able to work in the DC theater scene, mostly studio theater, and eventually started writing. So my background comes more from a theater background. I was trained as a dramaturg. So what I tend to bring to things is I'm always looking at it from the audience perspective, because that's what I was trained in. Jess comes and she's always looking at it from a craft perspective, because that's what she's trained in. And between the two of us, I think very often we're able to get down to, you know, what is the core of the story? What's the core of the emotion? And how can we best get that across? So co-writing with her was a hoot and a half, because we're both a little bit nuts. We both love monsters. We both love erotica. We both love, you know, religion in our story. So we kind of just threw it all together into this big mashed potato pot and ended up with Sin Eater. And it's awesome. I love that book.
So now, because you co-wrote that, tell me a little bit about what the co-writing process is between the two of you guys. Do you write a chapter and then Jess writes a chapter, or do you both add in things everywhere, or how do you do it? What's the process?
It's both of us. It's both of us. We'll sit down. We actually open up a Google document and we're both writing. We've got the little chat window open too, so we're constantly communicating at the same time. And it's a lot of it is just I'm bare bones and I tend to rush through things and I leave out a lot of emotion and a lot of descriptive details, and Pav comes in and she does her magic, you know, and it complements our two styles, complement each other in a way that makes something more than what either one of us could do alone, you know. And I'm always so in awe of everything I read from Pav. So it was really the first time I worked with her. I don't want to say I was nervous, but I was like, man, I'm the little guy here, you know, I'm the underdog. Why do you want to write with me? And, you know, it was just magic and it worked out so well.
So, you're so sweet. Dog. That's ridiculous. So both Jeff and the other editor who I work with regularly, Philip Lee, he does all of my science fiction and is also phenomenal, and I highly recommend him. Both of them are regularly getting up my ass about the fact that I'm totally histrionic. Like, everything I write is, if somebody's walking in a room, I've got them like skipping and throwing confetti. That's just how I do everything. So working with Jess made it possible so that it was reining me in, but also excited about the same thing I was excited about. So she reined me in enough that I wasn't going to be completely histrionic, but also it allowed us to go places that I sometimes don't go with my other work, because either I get nervous about it and stop myself, or I worry that readers aren't going to want that. And Jess and I would just get really excited about something and be like, fuck it, let's do it.
Co-writing is a hard thing to do, because you've got to make sure, like you guys were talking about, that your styles kind of mesh together, and it's good that you guys can layer
over we've been in critique each other like that. Together.
PK, can you hear me?
I can.
Okay, good. You guys are shaking your heads. I'm like, oh, crap, am I frozen again? Damn it. So you have some standalone novels of your own. You've got the Jakatu Vector, and it's a series. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, Jakatu Vector is the first book in the Jakatu series, and it is science fiction. It's really, you know, there's aliens, and there's cyborgs, and there's future dystopian Earth, but I think it's probably more akin to classic sci-fi. That's what I was really trying to hold to. I love Octavia Butler. I love Frank Herbert. I love L. Ron Hubbard, and you can all laugh, and I don't care, because Battlefield Earth is the best book ever written. So I really wanted to put something together that was my take on that epic, grand, classic sci-fi approach. And there's three books. They're all plotted. The next one will hopefully be out this fall if I get my ass on schedule. But the first one's out and it's done really well. And it was so much fun to write. And Holly Heise did the cover, which is an absolute treat. It's just exquisite. Like, it gives me thrills just to think about the cover, because it's exactly what I wanted. And she totally captured everything that I was trying to accomplish in the writing of the book in one single image, which is... And it was probably the scariest book I've ever written, though, because while I've done literary fiction, and I have a Muslim superhero novel, and I have lots of short stories, and all of them, while risky in their own way, weren't risky. They were risky to put out and see whether anybody would bother to read them. Two is the first thing that was really important to me in as an artist trying to do something that my heroes did. So being a great big sci-fi snob, it was really terrifying to put something out that would be judged alongside that same work that I've spent my whole life loving. I'm proud of it. It was a lot of fun to do. It was a lot of hard work. Philip totally kicked my ass, like, up and down the street, and I'm so thankful for it, because the book is tremendously better now than it was when I first wrote it. Yet never published that an editor. Anybody who's watching, ever, always get an editor. So yeah, that's Jaka too.
Okay.
Available everywhere.
So, Jess, what about your books? Tell us a little bit about your books, Jess.
I'm starting slowly. I'm going very slowly. I write mostly shorts now. I'm not in the novelist category yet, so I don't have full-length books out yet. The ones that I'm working on, I just got one back from a developmental editor. It's Faith of the Fallen, which I'm probably going to have to change the name of the title, because it's also the title of one of Terry Goodkind's books. And that's not going to work at all, because I'm a big fan of his work. So I should have really, it should have occurred to me sooner. But anyway, my work is, there's a lot of fantasy involved. And I like to take what we know about the Bible and about what people believe happened and, you know, how everything got started. And I like to play with that. I like to take the rules that were established and change them a little bit and try to approach that from a different perspective. So what I did was I went with Lucifer as a POV character, and I tried to tell his story. You know, why would he do the things that he did? He went from being the light bearer, you know, God's favorite angel, to being something else entirely, the complete opposite, to being, you know, God's antagonist, his number one enemy. And he, in my mind, that's one of the most interesting characters, I'll say characters in fiction, but, you know, one of the most interesting people, I guess, from the Bible. You know, I hate to say that he's a fictional character in a book, but, you know, that's kind of how I see a lot of that. But I found that had to be such an interesting story. I wanted to read that story. So I was like, well, I want to write that story, because it's been told and retold time and time again, but I haven't told it yet, and I have a different perspective on it, so I'd like to try that. And then it's also very much influenced by Dante's Inferno.
Oh, sweet.
So I've got a lot of that.
Hey, is that a kitty you've got there?
No, it's a puppy. It's my little puppy.
Oh, hi, sweetie. Well, she just needs some love, too.
I see it.
That's another thing that really brought Jess and I together, was this interest in historical and mythological and religious retellings. It's thanks to her that I wrote Book of Lilith, which is my retelling of the Garden of Eden story. And it's a short story. It's just a little something that was in the Mosaics anthology, which was an intersectional feminist anthology that I put together with Kim Wells. And Jess edited. I've always been fascinated by Lilith, and finally having someone else who was like, you know what? You need to just do it. You need to stop worrying about all the things that stop you from writing about religious topics and just write the character. And when I sat down and finally did it, it was so exciting. It's really a different book that got a lot of really cool attention.
I absolutely love learning about different faiths and different religions, both current and ancient religions from around the world. And I think that there are so many thousands of stories that can be told based on these myths or lore or faiths, if you want to say. I think that's a really interesting subject to delve into. I think it's really cool because, you know, whether you are a believer in Christianity or whatever religion you kind of point yourself toward, there are so many awesome little anecdotal tales and things like that can be turned into stories that are really interesting and that obviously appeal to people. So I don't know. I think that's...
The Bible is a really, really good book. It's a good book because you believe in what it's saying in a religious level, or whether or not it's a good book because it's full of really powerful stories. that's personal. But at the end of the day, I think we can all agree that there are stories in there that are powerful and that do have allegorical meanings and are really interesting, or else it wouldn't have lasted this long. It just wouldn't have. I enjoy that. I enjoy talking about all of that and playing with those tropes and assumptions that go along with religion.
Mm-hmm. Well, I love it when people can explore a different view on those same subjects too. You know, something we may have been taught growing up in either in school or in church or by our parents or friends, and then kind of taking a different twist on that to see where you can bring it. Where's Jess going? Jess, where are you going?
Are you on the toilet?
She's muted. Get off the toilet.
No. I have to bring my dog outside to pee, but she's whining. I brought her twice before we got started because I knew she was going to do the asshole. Yeah, now she's peeing.
Well, that's one of the things that we were saying, Jason. That's what was so interesting to me about Lilith, is that Lilith isn't actually in the Bible. She's not mentioned. There's an allusion to there having been a woman created before the story of Eve, but it's just one line in Genesis. And she's never given a name actually in the canonical Bible. But she's taken on this power in the Christian religion, but also in the Judaic religion specifically, has huge traditions like not naming children for 8 days. And that's all based on Lilith. Interesting lore to play with. And it's a little bit more freeing because it's not an actual biblical character, but it's still in that world.
That's cool, because it gives you something to work with, but not necessarily hard lines to follow.
Right.
Which is nice. So did we lose Jess? Are you frozen, Jess?
Not on my end.
Oh, okay, good. Good, 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 good.
We still, maybe?
Oh, but we've got your cute profile picture that I can see now, so that's great.
Oh. So, what is it?
So let's chat about canyons a minute here. We're all, the three of us are in this month's canyons, and you two, both Pav and Jess, have written for and worked with canyons for quite a while now, right?
Nope, this is my first time.
Is it really? No kidding. I thought that you were a longtime contributor.
Nope, this is my first story in canyons, and I am super excited because the talent that goes into these little anthologies is amazing. I'm excited to join your ranks.
No, it's fun. I was, you know, I found Daniel kind of by accident. I put a call out looking for people who published short fiction because I'd written a couple little short stories, and somebody turned me on to Daniel, and I don't know, it's awesome, all the stories in there. I mean, and every month I love it because you can just sit down and read the whole issue at once if you want, which is really nice for me because I don't always have time for a big thick novel, even though I enjoy them. You know, I'm busy. So I've got stuff to do, and it's nice to be able to squeeze these little stories in here and there. So cool.
Do you get like a physical copy of it, or is it just like an ebook?
They have an ebook and a print version available. I think this is Canyons number 15. So 15 of these monthly short story magazines, I guess you'd call them. And then he has several omnibus editions out as well. I'm not sure how many, but he kind of takes the best of throughout the year and compiles them into an omnibus. But yeah, they're pretty cool. It's a lot of fun. I'm geeked for people to be able to read it and to share it around. And then Katie and I also have a big anthology coming out. Is it tomorrow, Katie?
Tomorrow.
Wow. Well, when this show gets broadcast, it won't be tomorrow. It'll be the 31st. But yeah, it's called The Plague of Dragons, and it is not magical realism. It's straight fantasy, right, Katie?
It's a bunch of different genres within fantasy, because I think David has more of a sci-fi. His is more like, what is that? RPG style. So it's all realms of fantasy kind of touching on different ones.
The idea with the anthology was that they were all going to be dragon stories or stories with dragon shifters in them with a little bit of a steamy side as well. And that's kind of what
changed up everything. I remember it was originally supposed to be based off of fairy tales as a backing.
Oh yeah, that's right.
And then we kind of canceled that midstream, but mine has the Little Mermaid as its backing.
I didn't get that.
Really?
Really? There was no there was no singing in the whole thing.
No, no, he doesn't sing. He doesn't sing.
Singing a Little Mermaid song.
Yeah.
How did that come into play?
He wants to be part of her world.
I don't know. Little Mermaid was great, though. I love that movie.
Well, if you think about it, he's a character that belongs to a different world that's apart from the human world. He's absolutely obsessed with humans, and he finds a human who is equally obsessed with his world. Even though she doesn't know it's his world.
You have no idea the restraint I'm showing right now. Like,
come on.
I
can
tell you that I sing this song every day.
I was the Little Mermaid growing up, damn it. I love the Little Mermaid.
I have the red hair. Suck it.
Okay. There you go. Well, mine's faded right now, but I normally have the red hair too.
Come on, Pam. Let's hear it.
Which song are you going to sing that I want to be where the people are?
I want to be where the people are. I want to hear... Well, that's not right. I want to see him dancing.
Walking around on us. What do you call him again? Feet. Up where they run. Up where they play all day in the sun. Wandering free. Wish I could be part of
your world.
Oh, good job, you guys.
All my dogs are going batshit downstairs now. They're like, WTF.
Have you started working on, what was the story? What were you calling it, Jason?
I don't know.
The one that's in the Chronicles world? You called it something. I forget.
I don't know. Justine the Badass something?
Are you doing a Chronicles world?
I think we need to make that the title.
Well, no, Katie actually has a dystopian vampire series that's the Chronicles of the Uprising. So it's not a Samuel Peralta Chronicles. It's a different Chronicles. But Samuel, if you're out there, I want to work with you. I want to be in one of your books because I am a huge admirer and I love you. And yes, we're Facebook friends. Let's talk later. Okay, anyhow, Katie.
So. I don't know what happened.
We're going to have to cut that and then put that up on the page. That way, video testimonial.
You should put that on, like, your profile as your, on your Amazon page. Just like, this is what my fans think.
So Katie and I are attempting to co-write something, and I've kind of dropped out of the loop a little bit because... Well, because one, I'm super, super ADD, and we're moving. We've got all sorts of stuff going on, so I've kind of dropped the ball on it a little bit. But she has a super cool dystopian – is it YA? I consider it YA, but are we not YA? No?
No. The blue ball scene, dude. The blue ball scene. Yeah, I would not put that in a YA novel.
Fine.
Ask yourself if my 13-year-old can read it, and then that's your answer.
I'm so proud of that blue ball scene, by the way, when I showed it to Jason. I was like, you have to read this!
And I hated it. It's just like, you can't be proud. We hate that. That's the worst. That's the worst thing ever.
See, now I really want you guys to read Sin Eater, though, so that you can read what Jess and I did. I mean, we've got gay priest. We've got... Nuns having sex with candles. Like, it just, there was no line we didn't cross.
Perfect.
Oh, and Jess just texted me. She lost internet, but she'll try to log back in soon.
Okay. Aww. Okay.
It's just bad luck all around today. Just a lot of bad luck today.
It's crap.
But you did get me to sing Little Mermaid, so.
And that is going in the video.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
that's in there.
That might get its own separate distribution right there. So since we have just you, Pav, so Katie and I are going to try to co-write a story, and it's set in a world that she's already created with a character that already exists, and only she was my favorite character. So I was like, you know what? I only write female leads. That's all I do because. I don't know if it's because I'm not very in touch with guys or if I just, I don't know, but for whatever reason, I wanted to do that. And so what we've been doing, at least so far, is kind of writing a scene and then it bounces back and forth in the Google Docs. You know, she'll add something, I'll add something. Is there a way that you found that works really well for co-writing, or is it just kind of a something that you and Jess came up with on your own?
It really depends on the personality of the people involved. I've done a number of co-writing projects, some of them successful, some of them have been scrapped because it just went so badly. Some people write where you have two main characters and one of you takes each character and you just switch back and forth, because that way you don't have to make your voices blend. You know, if you write John and I write Nancy, then you write all the John scenes and I write all the Nancy scenes, and it doesn't matter that it doesn't sound like it's written by the same person. That's a really easy and fast way to work in a collaboration. I've not done that style because I never do the easy thing. Jess and I, the way we wrote, I would challenge someone to find a single sentence in that book that only one of us wrote, because we passed that monster back and forth so many times, chapter by chapter, word by word, sometimes in the same document, writing with each other. Sometimes one of us would write a chapter and then the other one would take it and just tear it apart. That worked well for us. Some people can't handle that. It's intensive time and it's really hard on your ego. I'm co-writing a space opera with SM Blooding, and we're having a hoot and a half. And what we did is we plotted the whole thing together, like beat plot, point by point. We plotted the whole thing together. And then we wrote like the first third, maybe quarter, passing it back and forth so that we made sure we were on exactly the same page. And then she was like, you know what? I can do this fast. If you're okay with it, I'm just going to pound out the rough draft. It'll be rough, but you can fix it. So she took it and she ran. And she did the whole first draft and then passed it on to me. And now that it's back to me, I'm changing every sentence. It's not like I'm not doing a full pass through and adding to paragraphs and moving things and changing chapters and writing new chapters to fill in where we need to. But it was easier for her to just sit down and write it and get everything that was in her head out before trying to talk about it. It's fine with me because I'm able to go back in and fill in the blanks. So I can't say that there's necessarily a right or a wrong way. I wrote a blog post a while ago about how Jess and I did it and why I think it worked so well. That is on my website somewhere. I don't know.
It really depends on how your styles mesh up. Absolutely.
Yeah, and also egos. If one person has a stronger ego than the other, it can be really hard to have somebody come in and go like, that sucks. That's not what I wanted.
I've worked with a couple of other authors before in a co-writing sense. And one of the ones that I've done long-term co-writing with, we have very different styles of writing and we bank on our strengths. I'm very good at the analytical and the dialogue. And so what I'll do is I will throw down scenes as fast as possible with almost all dialogue. It's almost like a screenplay. No actual settings, no descriptions, nothing. It's just like a running line of dialogue with tags. And then I set up what's happening based on in the dialogue. And he'll come through and he adds all the beautiful flowery language and the descriptions and what they're doing. And we layer over the top of each other like that.
That's similar to what Jess and I do, where she's more action, dialogue, forward momentum. She keeps me going forward. I can write 20 pages about looking out the window and never go anywhere. She keeps us going forward. And then I come in and I add in, you know, like three paragraphs of history and three paragraphs of setting and, you know, all the histrionic stuff, all the flowers.
Now, what we've done right now working with Jason, we've kind of each taken our own scenes at this point. We're kind of piggybacking off of what each person's wrote, which is not a bad thing either, because if we don't have a direction, neither of us has plotted this. Kind of the pantser approach, that works too.
I've liked what we've come up with so far. It's, you know, I wish that I was able to devote more time to it right at the moment. Oh, you've got a little cutie pie coming in and behind you. Aw. Hi, little one.
I was like, why are you at school? Who's here?
But no, I think it's been going pretty well with you, Katie. It's just, you know, we're kind of at a point where I've got to pause for a little bit. But yeah, you know, I wrote a scene and then she wrote a scene, then I wrote a scene and we both kind of went back and changed a few things here and there. And I am admittedly terrible at revision. So I like to blast something out and it might just be in one big, huge block paragraph and I'll go through and I'll fix all the problems with it. But I have a tough time going in and adding what you were just talking about, the flowery stuff. I have a tough time doing actual revisions. And so it's nice for me to work with someone who is really good with revisions and who's used to going through and layering another, another layer onto the story and adding things that way. So it's kind of been a learning process for me as well.
I kind of had to warn you ahead of time because my style is so bare bones to start with that what you see in the rough draft looks nothing like what you end up seeing in a final. It's like night and day, but it's kind of scary if you look at it at first. You're like, "Where's the story?"
Well, and I feel like I'm a kind of a mixture of, Pav. You were talking about how you like to write long, drawn out, or not drawn out, but longer descriptive things. What's that?
Make it sound awful. Thanks.
No, not trying to be awful, but
you're really boring. Long.
You're the boring one. Jess is the exciting one. Okay, I got that. But I feel like when I write, I get stuck into one of those modes where I might be writing a scene and it's for a short story that I'm actually writing right now for Daniel. And I'm like, what the hell am I doing? I'm on like paragraph 3 of description and I'm like, I've got to get this shit out of here. But I'm stuck there. I'm stuck in that mentality of description. And then other times it'll be all action and dialogue. And I'll go back and I'm like, man, where the hell is the story? All this crap is happening, but you can't see any of it. You can't feel any of it or hear any of it because I haven't given you that background. So I get stuck in those zones and it's tough for me to snap out of them. But is there anything that you two ladies would like to chat about towards the end of our show here?
I'd just like to let everybody know that we have the Dominion Rising box set on pre-order right now. It's up on all platforms and it is 22 stories by 26 authors for 99 cents, full-length books. And they're really phenomenal. Daniel, who we've been talking about, is in there. Sam Peralta is in there. Gwyneth White is in there. S.M. Blooding and I are writing the space opera. And just a shocking amount of talent is included in this giant monstrosity of a box set. And what makes it different is that they are full-length novels. So you're not getting short stories or novellas. So if people are interested in sci-fi or fantasy, we have both. We have some steampunk, we have some dragons, we have some fairy tales, we have space opera. Give it a look.
Awesome. Jess, anything you want to chat about?
No, not really. Just canyons. That's all I've got going on right now. Editing everything. Everything I've written is in one stage of editing or another. So there's nothing I have out. I'm focusing on editing and canyons, that's it.
Well, awesome. Thanks for hanging out with us today, guys. We'll see everybody next time.
Bye.
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 Thank you for listening to Spilling Ink.